wish I was in the land of cotton. Old times there are not forgotten. Look away, look away, look away.
Dixie, unless they play the goddamn federal song. You notice that? You know, it starts out good. Johnny Cash did the same thing. Well, I don't play that federal song around here. This is Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here in North Central Indiana. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana 46581. And thank you for getting your donations in for the radio show and any other thing that you want to send some money in. I'll tell you, a couple of guys have sent me this so-called debate between Alex Jones and David Duke. I stalled for about a week before I finally sat down last night and listened to it, because it was about 2 hours long. It was like listening to fingernails on a blackboard for about 2 hours. Unbelievable. Sure, they both said some correct things, but it's all the things that they said that weren't correct. Unbelievable. But they're quite a pair. Those guys ought to get a show together. Like Huntley and Brinkley. But there was so much double talking going on that I couldn't keep up with it. David Duke keeps calling white people European Americans. He don't want to say white. He's as bad as these other politicians. He don't say white. When's the last time you seen him in public or anything like that saying white? He might say it someplace on an internet or on a... And, of course, he denied he was a racist last night, too, on this debate. He claimed he wasn't a white supremacist, wasn't a racist. He was a good Christian, and he loved European Americans. Well, there's a lot of European types and even European Americans that are not white. They've come over here from Europe. They were born in Europe. I don't think that's a very good description of white people. I like white or Aryan. That's it. That's what you're going to get. Oh, no. European American. He plays that game. I don't even like white nationalists because I'm a white internationalist. White Aryan people around the world, not just in this nation. Of course, I'm for the good white people in this nation. They're few million that I don't have anything to do with and don't care to ever have anything to do with them and don't care to talk to them. Anyhow, it was an ordeal I don't want to go through very often, listening to both those guys. Now, of course, Alex Jones is just another Rush scumball, just a little more radical. He could come up with three or four ideas and switch around and come up with six or eight more before you can even tune the dial on the TV. Anyhow, Duke is slick, no doubt about that, and he's their favorite boy. Whenever they want to talk to a white supremacist, they call him out, and then he denies he's a white supremacist. I don't want to have anything to do with people who deny all the time. Now, I'm a white racist. There's no doubt about that. A white racial separatist. That's right. And I have been called a white supremacist, and I won't back down to it, that's for sure. I don't go around yelling white supremacy, but I think we're going to have to do it more and more. So if somebody claims to be a white separatist or some kind of a white leader and will refuse to accept the label of racist or white racist or white American or like that, and denies he could ever be a white supremacist, believe me, I've been with Duke enough times in the old days to know exactly what he is, and he's no Christian either, I'll tell you that. If he tells you he's a Christian, he just like all the rest of the lying Christians. And also, I noticed on this show he spent two-thirds or more of the time on Jews, going after Jews. He overdoes it on the Jew thing. He goes too far. He should suffice to say, well, we want the bad Jews punished, the bad Jews imprisoned, the bad Jews that are working against our race and a lot of other people into prison or on the scaffold. I got a bet for you. If some big shot Zionist Jew walked up to David Duke with a briefcase with $1 million in cash in it and said, David, all you have to do is take this money and leave us alone, my bet is he'd take it. Just like when the sale between one of the clans down south, Invisible Empire, Knights of the KKK, the leader turned out to be an FBI informant, tried to sell his mailing list to David Duke for $35,000. Duke wouldn't pay that. Of course, the list wasn't worth the paper it was written on, and he knew that. The value of a mailing list is how much you can wring out of the people on the list in money. The right-wing leaders, ever since I was involved in the 60s on, fight over mailing lists. They steal mailing lists. They do. Back when poor George Lincoln Rockwell was around, and James K. Warner, who calls himself a doctor, just like Duke, he's a doctor now, a doctor of history. Well, he doctors up history, that's for sure. But anyhow, James K. Warner told George Lincoln Rockwell his mother was sick over in Pennsylvania. He had to go and take care of her. And so Rockwell was a good man, a nice guy, very friendly, very loyal to you. He said, okay, James, you take off some time and then come on back. What he didn't know was that James K. Warner had the mailing list of the National Socialist White People's Party in the trunk of his car, in which he wasn't going to go see his mother. He was going down there to Georgia, to Edward Fields' operation, National States Rights Party. And he was going to sell or trade George Lincoln Rockwell's mailing list for a job with National States Rights Party. So that's what he did, and for a while Warner worked with the National States Rights Party. That's one reason I have no faith in organizations, because they got thieves around them and everything else. I can tell you more and more stories about these stolen mailing lists. It's sort of funny, really, because it's like, I don't know, it's just funny how many times it's happened. I don't know that it's happened lately, but up until about 10, 15 years ago, that was the biggest deal, steal the mailing list. Join up with an outfit, get to work in the office, and go out the back door with the mailing list, because that was a sucker list that they could get money off of, just like these guys do today. You know, it's like Duke and Don Black's big website and chat board. They got a big number of names, and that's where the money comes from. And so you got to have a big long list of people. So try not to get on those lists. Don't try not to get on those lists. It's suicide. And if you give enough money, they'll make you the grand poopah of some group. Yeah, that's the way that goes too. The right wing has been betrayed many times by people who come in and gave a big lump sum of money to the leader, and the leader gave him the keys to the kingdom. Even Richard Butler did that at his place up there in Idaho. And it's happened many places. Guy comes along, he swears he's 100% loyal white racist and the whole bit. Gives him a chunk of money, you know, maybe $1,000, $2,000, sometimes more. And come on in, brother, now you're the head of the recruiting, and we'll let you work right here in the office where we keep all the names. So for white racial separatists, these leaders have nothing on NASA. NASA's pikers compared to these guys. And if you ever wanted to have privacy, you wouldn't join a right-wing organization or a left-wing or any organization if you want to have privacy. Well, what do I know? I'm just this little old guy out here in the woods. Well, I received a note from one of our good friends or a couple of our good friends, and they donate, and that's good. And they wanted to make sure that Eric Rudolph gets some money. If he responds, please read it on the show. Well, 2 months in a row, two money orders for $25, that's $50, has gone out to Eric Rudolph. But I must say, I haven't heard anything back from him, so I don't know whether this is one of those deals. See, Eric Rudolph was an extreme devotee to Kingdom Identity. And I find it, a lot of these people that, and when you say you're not in with Kingdom Identity or whatever, they lose interest in you, they don't want to talk to you. Some of them are as bad as the regular Christian churches. You're in the Baptist church, you go down and join some other church, and you're an outcast. So I don't know if that's what's happening or not. But we'll keep sending him the money that you request, and plus other people, four or five of them. And we'll do our best to help these guys out. Now, if you want these guys to get more than $25 when I send out the postal money orders, which I have to pick up at the post office today, then send some more in. Send some more in. The donations to the radio show primarily take care of the bills of the radio station. They're not great big bills, but we do need support. But I'm not going to cry about support, because we get pretty good support for the small number of people that are on our list. I think I have more support than almost any of the right-wing groups have per capita. We've got several people who've been loyal for years. Now, this supporter says his autobiography, which must be Eric Rudolph's, Between the Lines of Drift is the title, has some interesting stuff you may want to read on the radio show. Not so much the childhood part, but after he started getting real active part. Anyway, just a suggestion. Google the title if you're interested in. Yeah, I will check it out. I didn't even know he had a... Here's another thing. If you're not hooked up with the right wing and pretty much have gotten away from the right wing altogether, there's some things you don't hear about. The donator says, I attended a gathering hosted by law enforcement some time back. An FBI agent gave a talk and stressed getting quality firearms and some good training. He also stated, in a roundabout way, that they're looking for snitches. Oh yeah, they're always looking for snitches. In fact, I told you before, several years ago, these agencies set up schools for snitches, where any housewife or anybody, senior citizen, could become an informant and get paid money. I think people ought to maybe join up and take the money and give them false leads of people that are not our friends. He's a deep cover lone wolf, that guy. That shoe's a deep cover lone wolf. Take my word for it. Give me the money. Yeah. He also stated in a roundabout way that, oh yeah, looking for snitches, and most cases are initiated by, you guessed it, snitches. Well, yeah. Some people make a living over the years, and my experience has been hundreds of them. They're usually people who've been on the wrong side of the law and got their ass in trouble, and they offer them a way out if they'll become a snitch. That's the main way they do that. But the trouble is, the quality they get's terrible. Several of these guys that tried to inform, get into my circle of friends, the quality of these people was not good. And then if they send somebody of quality, that raises your suspicion right away, because you say, what would any upstanding wealthy person want to do joining the right wing? He must be crazy. So you'd be more suspect of him than you would a bearded biker. Oh, it's crazy. It's crazy. But if you follow my suggestions and read the books I recommend, you can pick them out quite easily. Quite easily. Like, do you know where all the policemen live in your town? Well, I'll tell you, if you drive around your town, especially small towns, most of them drive their cars home, police cars home, which is, I think, is a bad security habit for cops. Yeah, because all you have to do is drive around town and through the housing areas, and every time you see a cop car in a driveway, you make a note of it. Not that you'll ever do anything nasty, but at least you'll know where they're at. And that goes probably for the mayor and the city councilman and a lot of other people, or any federal agents or anybody like that. I used to have a list of federal agents and where they lived and like that. Yeah, out there in Fallbrook, California. It's not important that you do anything physical. What's important is they find out that you know. Now, how would you feel about that? If you were an FBI man or Treasury man or ATF man and you knew that everybody that hates your guts, in most cases, knows where you live. I don't know. I don't think I'd feel too good about that. Not so much about the danger of people like me, but these drug cartel people. See, these cartels come into a small area and start working the town, and these guys don't play games, and you're a local cop, and you give them some trouble and think you're going to clean them out, next thing you know, your house goes up through the roof. Boom. Because they don't play games. I just watched this series, new series. You got to watch this. It's called Fargo. Not the original movie, but a series. It's on Hulu. And Billy Bob Thornton is the bad guy. And he is the baddest man I ever seen. And you'll learn how that operates with small town cops and professionals that come in from out of town. Yeah. Tune it in. It's only about 6 or 7 shows. Well, I keep checking on whether I can get on Facebook. I can't get on Facebook. I've been banned from a whole bunch of stuff. Banned from YouTube a long time ago. That was because of Boyd Rice, that used to be my friend. And he actually complained to YouTube, and I probably told you this before, that old Tommy had played one of his copyrighted songs on and put it on YouTube. Well, in fact, that song was on a show I did with him. He did 2 or 3 shows. He was a guest, and I interviewed him and was nice about it and interviewed him, tried to promote him, and he turns right around and complains to YouTube that I used a song that he put together. And then when I asked him to take care of it, he never did. So that's the way it goes, boy. Having trust in people is a tough thing. Huffington Post controls a whole lot of this left-wing stuff on the internet, and they put the word out on you. So I'm banned on Facebook, banned on Huffington Post. I don't know, I'm banned on some other stuff too, but I get on a lot too. There's still a lot of magazines and newspapers that have a comment section that you can comment. And so I still get a lot of that done, and you should be doing it too. It's easy to do, and it can do a lot of good, especially in a few words that you might put on that old internet. Well, I put a sign on the front of my refrigerator, Obama, stay in Alaska. Move in with one of those Eskimos. One of those big, fat, brown ones, yeah. You'll love it. You can eat seal meat. Yeah, all that blubber. Yeah. These kinds of news reports and these trips like this, it's all bullshit for the sheep. I mean, and if you're a race mixer and you love Obama and you're on the left, you believe anything he tells you. And on the other side, they don't believe anything he tells you, even when he tells you the truth. I think I've come to the conclusion not to worry about global warming or anything like that. So the water rises along the coast. Well, people got to learn not to build things right on the coast. Says in the next decade or so that this water is going to overflow all the military bases around on the coast. All those billions of dollars we spent on military posts, and we haven't even had a major war, and they're going to be destroyed. So if there's any money left, they're going to spend it all moving those bases inland. I think they said about 20 of these bases are going to be underwater in a few years. And most of the third world also live close to the water. And it wouldn't hurt my feelings if they got overrun by floods. I mean, come on, if we keep breeding, if the third world keeps breeding, forget about the white race. Forget about it. So, I think Mother Nature is on our side. I've said this before. Global warming, come on in. Keep it up. Then I could move up to Greenland and have a nice little ranch, raise cattle up there in Greenland, like the Vikings used to do back in the other, back in the cycle when it was warm on Greenland. Now, if I were young, I think I'd invest in some land in Greenland. I mean, why not? I mean, you could get right on the coast and start a hamburger stand for all those Russian icebreakers coming through. You know, the Russians got, 3,000 icebreakers, and we've got 3 or 4. Can you believe that? Those great big 500-foot long icebreakers, they've got hundreds of them, and we got 3. And they planted their titanium Russian flag underneath the North Pole. So this is us. Get out of here. This is us. You don't like it, we drop bomb on you. Yeah. Well, I see Iceland is going nuts. I thought Iceland was a pretty sharp place. They've opened the doors to massive numbers of migrants from Africa. Can you believe that? Iceland. They've opened the doors. It's one thing for the people to sneak in, crawl over the barbed wire and all that. But to open the doors to them like we have, it's crazy. Of course it's crazy. But there's methodology behind this whole thing. All of this exchanging white lands into non-white lands, it's not an accident. This is a well-planned situation, been planned for decades, decades and decades. They knew what they were doing. It's a transfer of population. They said, we can't figure this out. It's just people trying to go for a better life. Bullshit. Better life, huh? I'll give you a better life. Since the white race won't fight, not going to put up a fight, going to give them everything like we've given the niggers all the white working class jobs. They're not going to fight. Well, what the hell? They're going to come right on in no matter what country it is, no matter what white country it is. Because it's all planned that way. Oh, here's a good one. I finally said I'm going to take my old 99 Caravan with a bad transmission down to the wrecking yard because they said they'd buy it. I wouldn't get much out of it, but they'd buy it because trying to find a transmission for it is becoming more than I want to do. Well, anyhow, I'm tooling down there. I don't drive fast. I drive about 50 on a straightaway, sometimes 60, usually 50. And I'm coming up on the wrecking yard, and luckily there was nobody coming at me and nobody behind me. And all of a sudden, my brake pedal went straight to the floor. Could you imagine that? So very luckily, I had been slowing down to make the turn into the wrecking yard parking lot, and I was able to throw her down in first to break the RPM and come to a stop safely. But if I'd have been out on the highway, the interstate highway, doing 50, 60, 65, and that would have happened, hell, I don't know where I'd have ended up. Now, I'm not real paranoid. I think you understand that. But I had this van sitting up on the corner about a block from the house for a few days, and some of the yahoos found out the phone number. It was me. I had a couple of bad calls. So I'm going to put that thing up on the ramps and inspect those brake lines and see if there's any cut brake lines. I doubt it. It's probably just old age. But you never know. It's going to be quite interesting. I don't think there's that many people around here that got the balls to do an attempted murder. They do murder people around here, but usually over people going out with other guys' wives and drugs and things like that. Daughter of a friend of mine, or sort of casual friend of mine, was murdered a couple of years ago. I tried to help her figure it out because the cops didn't get anywhere. They never did solve it. They found her down by the lake, all decomposed and everything. I know it had to do with drugs because she admitted she was into a drug cult, or she was hanging out with druggies. And these druggies tend to be Mexicans. So they killed her. Nobody goes to jail. Nobody's arrested. And it's, if you don't listen, you'll have to feel. I told her, I said, look. Well, she said she couldn't control her. Well, if you can't control her, then she's on her own. And she's dead. These mestizos that are around here, they like the fat ones. Most of them like the fat ones. I guess that's comes from their experience in Mexico, where they got the big fat mamacita. So I see a lot of these thin, short mestizos coming through town, or maybe at Walmart, and they got a big fat white girl, white woman, maybe 200 pounds or so, and they're just happy as pig and slop. And they're having kids. But you wonder how a woman that fat, I mean super obese, can have a kid. But I guess they do. Have you noticed on television or any place anybody saying race anymore? It's all ethnicity. They've eliminated the word race. And that's all you hear on TV, radio, in the news. It's ethnicity or culture, not race. Wonder what that's all about. Oh, I forgot to mention in that Alex Jones debate, David Duke. Duke kept whining about not getting enough time. Alex Jones was giving him plenty of time, but Duke was going on and on, whining and crying about he wasn't getting enough time for his position. Well, if he hadn't spent so much time whining about the time, he'd have had plenty of time. It was embarrassing. It should have been embarrassing. Oh yeah, one other thing. Duke loves Tex Mars. He really loves Tex Mars. Well, I'm sure some of the stuff Tex Mars says is okay, but there's a whole lot of stuff that's la-la land out of Tex Mars too, because, and of course he's very pro-Jew. Yeah, but Duke loves him. And I never heard Tex Mars say anything disparaging about Negro people. I don't think he talks about black crime much. But Duke loves him. Oh yeah, Duke went along with the other side on, or no, with the right wing on Margaret Sanger. Now Margaret Sanger, you got to read about Margaret Sanger. She was into eugenics and trying to get the white race to breed up and get the blacks not to have so many kids and all that kind of stuff. And even whites, not to have so many kids you couldn't support them on the wages or pay you got. Margaret Sanger was a great lady. And I claim her as a white supremacist leader. David Duke didn't like her because he likes the right-wing conservatives. And anybody that says, well, maybe some women shouldn't have a kid. Oh, we can't say that. Every woman should have a kid. Now, our church is not going to support that kid. But every woman should be banging out kids for Jesus. More souls to go to heaven. Yeah.
In the international stock markets, to cause investors to take their money out and flee. Really, just get out of it. Get out of it. Bring the whole goddamn thing crashing down. That's the cause of all the problems on Earth. Poverty, lack of education, global climate disruption. It's all caused because of capitalism. And these stock market, these stock exchanges are the props holding the whole thing up. Crash, goddamn it. Crash. Crash. We'll be right back.
Well, I was mentioning the van this morning. And I told you guys, I don't believe in spending over $1,000 for a vehicle. A lot of guys will say, well, yeah, but a used car like that can't be perfectly safe. Well, I drove this van for 5 years, paid $1,000 for it, never let me down. But If you're worried about that, it's a hell of a lot cheaper to get a AAA policy of tow-in that'll tow you in for 150 miles, I think it is, and you can pay a little more and get up to around 250 miles with the policy. And I've used it a couple of times. So you can buy an older car, and if it breaks down, you can get towed in from almost any place. So remember that. Anyhow, my mechanic up there, he had a Cadillac I was interested in, but I decided not to because it was an Eldorado, all electronic, and I know how that goes. An older one, of course, for $1,000, but I said no. Too many things can happen to that. They even have a sealed transmission. Don't have a dipstick for the transmission. Anyhow, I saw a van sitting in the back of his shop there, and I said, what's that one there? He said, that's a Pontiac Montana. And I said, well, what do you want for that? And he said, $800. I said, deal, baby. Deal. And I was talking to another mechanic friend of mine. Asked him, what's a good van? Well, he said he had a buddy that had a Pontiac Montana van that he had 370,000 miles on it. I said, well, it looks like I hit the jackpot. How about that? Well, I've dug out a book that I haven't seen for a while, and it's called Racial Hygiene, Medicine Under the National Socialists by Robert N. Proctor. So we'll read a few pages here and see if you've ever heard anything about this stuff. The American Connection. It was in the United States that theory was first turned into practice in this sphere. In 1907, Indiana passed the first laws allowing sterilization of the mentally ill and criminally insane. By the late 1920s, 28 American states and one Canadian province had followed suit, which was a good idea, according to T.T., enacting legislation that resulted in the sterilization of some 15,000 individuals before 1930, many of them against their will. Yeah, well, at most while incarcerated in prisons or homes for the mentally ill. By 1939, more than 30,000 people in 29 states, American states, had been sterilized on eugenics grounds. Nearly half the operations, 12,941, were carried out in California. I remember seeing a documentary on the guy that was the foremost guy in doing that. During World War I, German racial hygienists expressed their concern that Germany's adversaries might surpass the fatherland in racial health. At least some government was worried about that. In 1917, when Berlin branch of the Society for Racial Hygiene proposed strong measures to improve the quality of the race, American and English achievements in this field were held up as models worth emulating. The hygienists warned that the serious consequences could follow if Germany's enemies were to advance in this field while Germany remained behind. Sterilization was not the only thing implied here. German racial hygienists also pointed to American immigration policies, according to which only the fittest were allowed in and inferiors sent back to European motherland. Oh boy, the good old days. After World War I, the German racial hygienists continued to express their admiration of America's achievements in this field. You see, the United States was ahead of Germany at this time. And a lot of the ideas that were being practiced here were adopted by Adolf Hitler. In 1924, Dr. Gustav Boters, one of Germany's most persistent advocates of sterilization, defended the sterilization of mental inferiors with the following argument. What we racial hygienists promote is by no means new or unheard of. in a cultured nation of the first order, the United States of America, that which we strive towards, that is sterilization, legislation, was introduced and tested long ago. It is all so clear and simple, unquote. 1 year later, Professor Otto Risch, chairman of the Vienna Society for Racial Care, expressed his fear that the Americans were becoming world leaders in racial hygiene and urged Germans to try to catch up. Wow. Where have we gone? Racial care, Risch asserted, must become the foundation of all domestic policy, and at least a part of the foreign policy. And you can believe that Margaret Sanger supported these views. In 1932, of course, David Duke doesn't like Margaret Sanger. In 1932, on the eve of Hitler's rise to power, the historian science Reinhold Mueller described the relation of America and Germany in this matter as follows. Racial hygiene in Germany remained until 1926 purely academic and scientific movement. It was the Americans who busied themselves earnestly about the subject. Through massive investigations in the schools, they proved with impeccable precision Galton's thesis that qualities of the mind are as heritable as qualities of the body. They were also able to show that these mental qualities are inherited according to the very same laws as those of the body. As early as the late 19th century, German racial hygienists looked to America for leadership in racial hygiene. In the 1890s, Alfred Plotz had traveled to the United States to try to implement his racial ideals in the tiny utopian community of Icarus in central Iowa. Although Plotz's experiment failed, German medical authorities in subsequent years continued to refer to the United States for lessons on racial policy. At the turn of the century, German health authorities studied legislation in North Dakota disallowing marriage for alcoholics, the insane, and individuals suffering from tuberculosis. Health authorities reported on laws passed in 1899 in Michigan, according to which idiots, the insane, and individuals suffering from gonorrhea or syphilis were not allowed to marry and could be punished with fines of up to $1,000 or prison terms up to 5 years for violating statutes. In the early 1900s, officials of the Reich Health Office took notice of these laws and included them as the first entry in what was to become the large file on racial hygiene. German interest in American sterilization continued through the early 1930s. In 1931 edition of Human Selection, Fritz Lenz cited the American eugenicist Harry H. Laughlin's view that a proper sterilization effort in the United States would encompass 100,000 individuals in the first few years, rising to 400,000 a year by 1980. Laughlin had pointed out that with such a program, one could sterilize approximately 15 million individuals of inferior racial stock by 1980. Lenz noted that sterilization on such a scale would certainly contribute to the health of the race. He also claimed, however, that Laughlin's figures were modest and that one might well afford to sterilize an even larger fraction of the population. Just think if that would have been carried out, what the race would be like today, the white race. Sterilization was not the only area in which German racial hygienists learned from the Americans. In the Weimar period, a number of American works on eugenics and racial theory were translated into German. In 1925, Madison Grant's Passing of a Great Race appeared in translation, as did Lothrop Stoddard's Revolt Against Civilization, The Menace of the Underman. Two of the most widely cited American studies were Richard Dugdale's study of the Jukes and H.H. Goddard's study of the Kallikaks. According to Dugdale's celebrated study, Mr. Jukes, a colonial frontiersman, married into a defective family and produced a horde of degenerate offspring. Dugdale was able to trace 709 descendants that found that 181 were prostitutes, 106 were born illegitimately, 142 were beggars, 64 were housed in public expense, 184 had not had been prostitutes, and 70 had been convicted of criminal offenses, 7 for murder. According to Dugdale, this single family cost the New York government more than $1.3 million from 1730 to 1874. Just think of what it is now. Equally famous was Goddard's story of the Kallikak family, one of the first works of American eugenics to appear in the German translation in 1914. Martin Kallikak was the pseudonym given by the author to a New Jersey man who had married a common tavern wench of inferior racial stock. From this unhappy marriage came 480 offspring, 46 normals, 143rd feeble-minded, 33 immoral, mostly prostitutes, 8 bordello owners, 24 severe alcoholics, 3 epileptics, and countless other assorted degenerates. Kallikak also married a fine, upstanding, healthy woman, and from this second marriage came 496 descendants, all fit, healthy, and respectable citizens. German racial hygienists commonly cited the Jukes in the Kallikak studies as evidence of the primacy of heredity over environment. They also sought and found their own examples of such families, such as Zero, Victoria, and Marcus, were the example each of which told a story similar to those of the Jukes and the Kallikaks. In each case, the lesson was that heredity is more important than environment in the determination of moral, intellectual character, and that one single genetic defective could spoil an entire ancestral line. Now think what it's like now with niggers marrying into a white family. Nigger getting right in there. Do you think all these others, they didn't really have this much of a problem with that back in the day. They're just more or less white degenerates. But today, oh, shit. Oh. German racial scientists were also impressed with America's 1924 immigration restriction laws and the anti-miscegenation laws that existed in many states in the American South. Bavarian health inspector Walter Schultz, for example, in a 1932 article, quote, "The Nordic Ideal," written for the official journal of the Nazi Physicians League, argued that racial hygienists must learn from the United States, where racial laws had recently been enacted to restrict the influx of Jews, Poles, and Southern Europeans. Based on its experience in both the sterilization program and the immigration restriction laws, the United States was to be regarded as a nation where racial policy and thinking have become much more popular than other countries. Schultz, in subsequent years, also praised South Africa legislation forbidding black-white intermarriage. He linked such laws with German efforts to restrict German-Jewish intermarriage. The importance of the United States as a model continued even after the rise of the Nazis to power. In the spring of 1933, with the beginning of the Gleichschaltung, I can't pronounce that word, of the German medical profession, German medical journals declared that America had already solved its Jewish question by prudent immigration restrictions. The April 1933 issue of the Deutsche Ärzteblatt claimed that America, unlike Germany, had little need to defend itself against Jews because in its 1924 immigration restriction laws had already guaranteed that unwanted racial elements could no longer gain entry. The journal also noted that America had no intention of opening its doors to Jews fleeing Germany. One could cite many other examples where the German racial hygienists looked to the United States for inspiration. In this sense, German racial hygiene followed the American lead. American eugenicists were in turn impressed by the German achievement. Laughlin, Davenport, and other eugenists were envious of the thoroughness in which the German racial measures were administered. When the Nazis opened the first race bureau for eugenic segregation in Dortmund, aimed explicitly at purifying the German race of its Semitic elements, one anonymous member of the Eugenics Record Office in Cold Spring Harbor remarked that Hitler, quote, should be made honorary member of the Eugenics Records Office, unquote. Laughlin also boasted that the German sterilization program had been inspired at least in part by his own model sterilization program and law. In 1936, Laughlin traveled to Heidelberg to receive an honorary doctorate. He returned to the United States with a copy of the propaganda film Erbkrank, The Genetic Deceased, which he showed to the staff of the Carnegie Institution at the Eugenics Records Office. Alice M. Hellmer, office, noted that in 1937, a letter reproduced by the SS Office of Race and Settlement, that Laughlin was so impressed by the film that he intended to make a similar one for American audiences. Until 1933, sterilization was illegal in Germany, as in most other European countries. Proposals to allow some form of voluntary sterilization were rejected by the Weimar legislators. Despite periodic attempts by health authorities to have such laws passed, progress in this direction was finally made in the last years of the Weimar Republic. On July 2nd and 3rd, 1932, the Executive Committee of the German Medical Association, along with the Prussian Health Council, met to discuss, among other things, the question of eugenics in the service of the economy. At a September meeting later that year, the Council voted to approve limited medically supervised and voluntary sterilization designed to stop the breeding of genetic defects. In the fall of 1932, legislation was placed before the German Parliament to allow voluntary sterilization. The sterilization law passed by the Nazis in the summer of 1933 simply changed the language of the Weimar proposal to allow for compulsory sterilization on eugenics indications. Unquote. The new law allowed for sterilization only of supposedly homozygous carriers of genetic diseases. Sterilization of recessive carriers was forbidden and remained punishable as a criminal offense. This presupposed, of course, that the various indications for which one could be sterilized, feeble-mindedness, schizophrenia, alcoholism, and so on, were single-gene traits that followed the simple rules of Mendelian genetics. Today we know that such a notion is virtually meaningless. Well, you may know it. I don't think I know it. German sterilization law was explicitly intended to be eugenics rather than punitive. That is, persons ordered sterilized were not to be considered perpetuators of a crime for which they were receiving punishment. Rudolf Rahm described sterilization as the sacrifice an individual makes as a result of personal tragedy of having been born defective. Blame it on your parents. By submitting to sterilization, such individuals break their link in the chain of generation as a sacrifice in the interest of the good of the folk. Rahm did recognize that feeble-mindedness and other disorders covered by the law might be the product of environmental rather than hereditary influences. He nevertheless advised that it was better to err on the side of caution. In such cases, that is, to go ahead with sterilization, as even slight impairment could conceal more severe deficiencies. Although the German sterilization law was not intended to be punitive, some did believe that the sterilization of genetic defectives might help eliminate crime. The prison cleric, Abel, for example, maintained that both sterilization law and the laws allowing castration for certain kinds of criminal acts would have less this effect. He argued that when one reflects upon the fact that some proportion of the genetically ill are also morally defective and have broken the law, then one can easily understand how important sterilization may be in helping to reduce criminality. The new law was administered on a massive scale, 1,700 genetic health courts and appellate genetic health courts were originally envisioned to determine who and who should and who should not be sterilized. Racial hygienists reported to the international press that the cost of the program would run about $14 million, more than $5 million American dollars at this time. Officials declared that this amount was negligible. However, compared with the cost of hereditary disease to the nation as a whole, estimated at 350 million to 1 billion Reichsmarks annually, Walter Gmelin, head of the Schwabish Hall Health Office, predicted that the sterilization law would save Germany billions of marks in coming decades. So it's staying out of the war. In 1934, 181 genetic health courts and appellate genetic health courts were established throughout Germany to educate the sterilization law. The courts were usually attached to local civil courts and presided over by lawyers and two doctors, one of whom was expert on genetic pathology. Especially after 1935, the courts had become involved in helping decide who was fit to marry whom. And according to the 1935 Nuremberg laws, the primary responsibility of the courts, however, was to adjudicate the sterilization law. According to its provisions, doctors were required to register every case of genetic illness known to them, except in women over the age of 45. Article 9 of the law allowed fines up to 150 Reichsmarks for any doctor failing to register such a person. Individuals were usually left first to recommend for sterilization by their physician, who would present his analysis to the local genetic health court. German physicians recognized that the presentation of detailed medical records before the court without the permission of the patient altered traditional privacy of the doctor-patient relationship. Medical journals in the early years of the Third Reich frequently discussed how the rights of the individual to have their medical records kept confidential appeared to conflict with the broader obligation to maintain the general health of the German population. The question of privacy was ultimately resolved by requiring physicians to report cases of genetic illness in the same way they were required to report births and deaths or certain infectious or venereal diseases and so forth. The proceedings of the courts were kept secret in order to preserve confidentiality. Physicians were also instructed, however, not to share the information submitted to the courts with the patient whose reproductive future was in question. Such information was to be seen only by the physician bringing the charge and the officials of the genetic health court. The courts were granted the power to subpoena medical records. Hospitals and physicians were required to comply with these requests. The proceedings of the genetic health courts were secret, and even today most of their records are protected under German laws guaranteeing that certain data will remain confidential. Nevertheless, some sense of the philosophy and workings of the courts can be gleaned from legal and medical sources of the time, especially from the journal Der Erbbots, the genetic doctor. Authors for the Virchow's Erbbots included some of Germany's most prominent or eminent biologists, the geneticist N.V. Timofeev Rezovkovsky, for example, in a 1935 article, argued that genetic pathologies accumulate in the population wherever civilization has interrupted the natural struggle for existence. Under such circumstances, pathological mutations multiply unchecked. It was important for racial hygiene not only to determine who was obviously genetically sick, but also to identify the heterozygous carriers who might show no symptoms. Timofeev maintained that this would not only serve the purpose of racial hygiene, but would also help in the facilitate the classification of certain genetic diseases. In his introduction to the first issue of the journal, Virchow cited four legal measures that had begun to address the problems of racial hygiene. Number one, the Civil Service Law of April 7, 1933, according to which all non-Aryans were dismissed from government posts. Number two, the broad set of measures designed to allow the retraction of citizenship from elements of the population judged undesirable, especially the recent immigrants. The series of laws designed to prevent further immigration of racial enemies. Four, the sterilization law. He also cited other measures designed to promote racial hygiene, such as loans for newly married couples, measures designed to relieve the tax burden for large families, incentives designed to keep German families on the farm, and to the establishment of offices for the family counseling. Rochour drew attention to the wealth of the new words that had been added to the German vocabulary as a result of racial hygiene. There were the Urquhartii genetic files and the genetic clinics. People spoke of genetic health, and they spoke of genetic illness, genetic diseases. There were the new scientists of genetics and of Erbrecht genetic law. There was the genetic doctor and the student of genetic pathology. There were genetic health courts, genetic officials, and genetic chambers. There were genetic pollution and the new hereditary farms. The term genetics itself, Virchow pointed out, was coined by Eugene Fischer in 1926 with the establishment of his Kaiser Wilhelm Institute of Anthropology, human genetics, and eugenics. The first health court met in March 15, 1934 in Berlin. Over the next 2 months, this court heard 348 cases and ordered 325 sterilizations. In 143 cases, the application for sterilization was placed by the individual. In the remainder, sterilization was requested by hospital directors, state or court physicians, or the legal guardian of the person to be sterilized. Most of those who received the so-called Hitler cut were between the ages of 20 and 40, but 5% were over 50. In the first year of the sterilization law, 1934, genetic health courts received 84,525 applications for sterilization, 42,903 for men and 41,622 for women. During the same period, 64,499 decisions were handed down by the courts, 56,244 in favor of sterilization, and 3,692 against. 4,563 requests were either retracted or postponed. The courts decided in favor of sterilization in over 90% of the cases heard. The enthusiasm which courts prosecuted genetic inferiors differed in different parts of the country. In the first year of the law, the Genetic Health Court of Dresden was the most vigorous in its prosecution, handling 4,152 cases. Berlin was next with 3,509 cases, and the Court of Ham was third with 3,095. The fewest cases were recorded by Oldenburg with 473, Marienwerder with 285, and Braunschweig with only 212. Individuals who had been ordered and sterilized were guaranteed the right to appeal their decisions to appellate genetic health courts, and many did so. In 1934, for example, nearly 4,000 persons, above 7% of the total, appealed their decisions. 370 were successful. So you can see that the United States went from being the top eugenics country in the world, very much concerned with its racial population and the health of its population, down to being nothing but a third world dump. And even the Germans had to copy American eugenics programs. So there you go. There was a whole lot of things that the Germans copied off the United States prior to World War II. A whole lot. Now, trying to take it back from here, as bad as it is now, even with a 100% program to do it, being willing to spend maybe $1 trillion in today's money, it would take decades and decades and decades to straighten it out, if it is even possible. That's what your enemies have done to your race. And that's what they continue to do. And that's why a majority of whites go right along with it. It's wonderful. And anyone that would want to improve the race, they've got to be rats or inferiors themselves. In other words, healthy Aryans now are the inferiors. Okay, that's it. Five words. I'll see you tomorrow. Wotan's Day. Thank you.
bring a horse for me?
Looks like we're... Looks like we're shy of one horse.
You brought too many.